evening and welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is Chris Hedges. Hedges was a foreign correspondent for nearly two decades, reporting for such papers as the New York Times, the Christian Science Monitor, and the Dallas Morning News. He was a member of the team that won the 2002 Pulitzer Prize for explanatory reporting for the New York Times coverage of global terrorism. He is the author of the highly regarded War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning, and the more recently published Losing Moses on the Freeway, The Ten Commandments in America, published by Free Press last summer, and the book we're going to discuss this evening. I'm speaking to Chris Hedges by phone from his office in New Jersey. So thank you so much for being with us, Chris Hedges. It's really a pleasure to have you here.
Well, thank you.
Listen, I want to begin with the very personal story you tell at the beginning of Losing Moses on the Freeway. As a young divinity student, you went to live in one of Boston's poor, despairing ghetto neighborhoods. Tell us how this experience shaped you and your thoughts about the Ten Commandments.
It was, even though I spent probably 20 years of my life as a war correspondent, I still think those 2.5 years I spent in a public housing project in Roxbury were the most formidable period of my life. It was the first time I'd really confronted systemized repression and on a daily basis had to deal with what the callousness of our society, you know, what we do to the poor, how we discard them as human refuse. Or treat them as human refuse, how we keep them locked within these urban ghettos and how difficult it is to escape. I also had to confront, you know, my own self-righteousness and the self-righteousness of the church that I had grown up with. The mainstream, I was a Presbyterian, but the mainstream church had left the inner city with white flight. I was living in Roxbury, but commuting into Cambridge to go to Harvard Divinity School. And both Harvard Divinity School and the liberal Protestant church that I came out of took it upon themselves to speak on behalf of the poor. Mm-hmm. But they were speaking on behalf of people they never met. Mm-hmm. And I think that for me it was a huge insight into the kind of hypocrisy that was taking place within the institution itself, that the church had walked away from the inner city, moved out to the affluent suburbs with their white congregations, yet continued to feel that they had a right to get up and speak on behalf of the oppressed. Mm-hmm. And I think the other thing that I had to confront was my own image of myself. Going into the ghetto, I had visions of being lionized and lauded for my own goodness and for helping the poor, and I had to come to terms with my own complicity in that system of repression, that institutional repression that anyone who's lived in a ghetto for any period of time knows very well. And that came through a long confrontation that I described with two heroin addicts, Patrick and Tyrone, who I banned from my street, and they were squatting in abandoned houses, and I was calling the police to remove them or evict them, boarding up their windows, taking the fuses out of the fuse box so they wouldn't have electricity, calling their probation officers. Although they were on the books as going to the Boston public school system, they never appeared. They were functionally illiterate. I mean, they couldn't even read subway mm-hmm. signs. Mm-hmm. And it came down to a real confrontation between them and myself. And I had to cope with the fact that when I was afraid and when I wanted to, I could turn to those instruments of repression, the courts, the police, the probation officers, and use them to get what I wanted. And I began to see myself in another light. Mm-hmm. I began to see my role as a seminarian differently, that, you know, in many ways what I had done was go to church to worship my own virtue, and that in many ways church was my last refuge from God. Mm-hmm. It was a long, painful, and bitter process, but a deeply important one, because I think it's only when we confront our own sinfulness, our own darkness, that the moment of real faith can begin.
Mm-hmm. And you graduated from seminary at Harvard School of Divinity, but you decided not to become ordained, and instead you left for El Salvador to cover the war. War really runs through this entire book. This must have shaped your feelings about the Ten Commandments as well.
Yes. You know, I'd finished 2 years of divinity school, and really soured on both the institutional church and sort of liberal divinity schools that lived off in their little islands of privilege, such as Harvard Divinity School, and took a year off and lived with the Maryknoll Fathers, the Catholic Missionary Society in Bolivia and Peru, and then finally lived on my own in Argentina, studied Spanish at the Maryknoll Society Language School in Cochabamba, Bolivia, and freelanced, wrote for the Washington Post, ended up covering the Falkland War for National Public Radio out of Buenos Aires, and then decided that I wanted to go back to Latin America as a journalist, that, you know, one of my great influences was George Orwell, and in the early 1980s in Latin America, most of these countries were run by very despotic military regimes that unleashed terrible repression against their own people. In Argentina, 30,000, the military dictatorship disappeared, mm-hmm. 30,000 of their own people, the death squads, in the 1982, 1981, 1983, in El Salvador were killing between 800 and 1,000 people a month. Pinochet was in power in Chile. 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 Chileans were disappeared, and I felt that this was as close as my generation was going to come to fighting fascism. So I took that year off, and then was convinced that that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to go back to Latin America and be a freelance reporter. But I did finish my degree. Mm-hmm. I was not ordained, and as soon as the degree was completed, I turned around and went off to cover the war in El Salvador. And that war, in essence, although I didn't know it at the time, would come to mark the next two decades of my life.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, let's begin to talk about some of the commandments that you talk about in your book. Let's begin with the third commandment. You shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain, which you title lying. And you talk about how our consumer society is saturated in lies. Well, let's talk a little bit more about that.
Yeah. You know, let me back up to answer a question that you'd asked earlier about the commandments themselves and the attraction of them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I grew up in the church. My father was a minister. Of course, I studied the commandments as well as the rest of the Bible in divinity school. But I lived pretty much in a secular world. I'd been a news reporter or a foreign reporter for the New York Times. When I came back from overseas, the last war I covered was the war in Kosovo. I came back to New York, and the Brooklyn Academy of Music was showing this 10-part film series called The Decalogue.
Which was a great, great series.
Yeah, it's really, I think, one of the great pieces of cinema, and oftentimes you'll find it on Film Critics' top 10 list,
mm-hmm.
By the Polish filmmaker Krzysztof Kieslowski, who also did the trilogy Red, White, and Blue that was a little more widely seen. And in 1988, he went in for Polish television to this Warsaw housing complex, and he filmed 10 sort of roughly 60-minute pieces, each one built around one of the themes in the commandments. And what was so striking about the film, and I think what made it so brilliant, is that he stripped away all the piety and often our conventional understanding of the commandment to get to the core issue that the commandment grappled with.
Mm-hmm.
And I think when you grapple with that core issue, it's far more complex than it often appears with a very cursory reading. For instance, in the commandment about adultery, he profiles the story of a woman who's not even married. She just has a series of carnal relationships without love.
Yes, I remember.
Or in Honor Thy Father and Mother, the biological mother is absent, and the father, who is not the biological father, is raising alone his daughter. And it's this deep understanding that parenthood it's not about gender, it's not about bloodlines, it's not about race, it's about fidelity, it's about compassion, it's about mm-hmm. commitment, it's about love. And he did that through all of them. And the commandments, you know, he really, when I walked away from that series, they were being shown two a night over five consecutive weeks. You know, it was a fictional account, obviously. I decided to do it in a non-fictional way, to reach out in the society and use each one of those commandments as a kind of lens to look at American society.
Mm-hmm.
So when getting back to the question you raised about lying, what I did, and I also wanted to go into different stratas of society.
Mm-hmm.
So for that chapter, I was in these whiskey bars out in Hempstead, Long Island, where illegal immigrants gather on the weekends. And, you know, they live in fear of being picked up by the INS. They, you know, to call them second-class citizens is probably an understatement. I mean, these are people who live in our midst but are virtually invisible. They have no legal rights. They don't have health care. They're abused by workers. They can by their employers. They can be deported at any time. They're often living six or more to a room, mostly men. Their families are back in Honduras. In the case of Long Island, they're mostly Central Americans, back in Honduras, Guatemala, El Salvador. And on the weekends, after they get paid, they go in and they and these whiskey bars, anyone who's traveled around the world, you know, they're in any port in the world, you can pay, you buy drinks for a young woman, and which are, you know, horrendously overpriced, and as long as you keep paying for her drinks, she will chat with you and dance with you.
Mm-hmm. And a semblance of intimacy, right?
Yeah, it's very sad. It's a heartbreaking scene. And the men themselves, you know, if you ask them, they know they're being conned. I mean, they know what the game is. They know they're being lied to. Yet the lie is so much more preferable to the loneliness and isolation and lack of intimacy that they get all during the week. And then, of course, you know, lying at night in these rundown apartments where they're all sleeping on the floor. Mm-hmm. And so I chronicled this and spent several nights in these bars and built the story around it. But I began to see in their lives a reflection of our own lives. That, you know, on a cruder level, they are undergoing what we all undergo in a consumer society. All of us are lied to by advertisers. And, of course, they do it, and I mean, at this point, politicians, and they do it in a very sophisticated manner. They know how to appeal to our emotion. They know how to appeal for our longing to belong, to be worth something, to be venerated, to be admired. And the products that they offer presumably will, of course, give us this happiness.
And respect, and
the
people
respect,
will envy
exactly.
us. And you conclude by saying it never works.
Well, it never does work.
Right.
And, mm-hmm. of course, that is the brilliance of a well-oiled consumer society, because it doesn't work, and you keep turning to something else and something else and something else without ever actually coping with the source of, I think, the loneliness which mm-hmm. runs through American society, or the solitude or the despair itself, which is really the loss of community.
Right, and people feel like they'll never have enough no matter what. That's what this consumer society tells us. Yeah.
Why are so many people taking Prozac? You know, they're not crazy. I mean, there's something very sick about our society. And I just did a piece in Egypt and was living in a poor village for several weeks. And I don't want to romanticize poverty in any way, but the communal structure, I mean, the constant interaction, the communal events, all of that is lost. I mean, especially if you look out in these exurbs or, you know, these long, ugly strips, there is something, there's a deep illness that has beset our society.
So you're talking about strip malls, right, in our current society you're talking about?
Yeah, or, mm-hmm. you know, these long, you know, I just finished a book on the Christian right, so I'm traveling all over the country, and I'll mm-hmm. be driving around, a long sort of four-lane highway in Detroit, and, you know, I'll get a flash. I'm not sure where I am. Am I outside of Kansas City? Am I in Florida? I mean, it can be anywhere.
That's right. Yeah.
And it's almost a sense of vertigo. I mean, you don't. It's ugly. It's tawdry.
It's soulless. It's deadly. Exactly.
And that's why, you know, these big mega churches, which are very frightening phenomena, are growing mostly in the exurbs. I mean, these people don't have sidewalks even. Mm-hmm. There is no, you know, they live in these big empty houses with palladium windows and get in these big empty cars and drive to these big soulless offices. I mean, there's more to their lives than that. But I think that there certainly is a deep disconnectedness mm-hmm. within the society. Mm-hmm. And the solutions that we look for, or that we're offered, let's say, to counter that disconnectedness and that loneliness are ones that only make it worse.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk, because you know so much about this as well, let's talk about the sixth commandment, you shall not kill, which you title murder in your book. Now, and you know, you worked for 20 years as a correspondent covering wars. Tell us how people fail to follow this commandment constantly in all cultures.
Well, you know, there's the big debate between biblical scholars as to whether the Bible is saying thou shalt not kill, which I think is the traditional interpretation, or whether they really mean thou shalt not murder.
Mm.
And it revolves around the Hebrew word, I don't speak Hebrew, but revolves around the Hebrew word rosh and how to interpret it. I certainly interpret it, I do see a difference between killing and murder,
mm-hmm.
Killing being the taking of a life of somebody who's trying to do you harm, murder being the taking of a life of somebody who does not have the capacity to do harm to you. Murder is always part of war, however,
mm-hmm.
and in an insurgency, such as the war in Vietnam or the war in Iraq, there's far more murder than there is killing, because the enemy is elusive. You can't see them. And the one of the things that I loved about the Kieslowski films and that I was determined to do in the book was not go out and do the obvious. I mean, not, you know, run off and find somebody who was sitting locked up forever in a prison who'd committed a murder.
Or sitting on death row, yeah.
Right. But to perhaps, and in Kieslowski's case, he profiled a guy who brutally and viciously kills a cab driver and then is put to death by the state.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's a kind of implicit condemnation of that sort of deranged individual who commits a senseless murder, but as well those who, you know, bloodlessly and coldly commit murder in the name of the state authority. In my case, and of course war is something I know very well, I went and profiled a former platoon leader in Vietnam, highly decorated, awarded the Silver Star, whose job during the war was to set up ambushes for Viet Cong, North Vietnamese, and Chinese mercenaries. And once those ambushes were completed, and of course they were over very quickly, they had to immediately execute the wounded because their cries would give away the position of the small company that had set up the ambush.
You are listening to Out of Bounds on WEOS. I'm Tish Perlman, and my guest is Chris Hedges. So go ahead and complete that thought. We're talking about murder.
So this was, he describes this. He went into the church afterwards. He's now an Episcopal bishop. I mean, very much as a result of this experience. But, you know, in his own words, he said, let's not mince words about it. You know, I mean, I don't know if this is a direct quote, but, you know, I violated the commandment. I committed murder. I violated the commandment, thou shalt not kill. And that was really a starting point for him when he came home from the war. And how to cope with that,
mm-hmm.
How to cope with that knowledge that you have taken another life. He talks about how after they had completed the ambushes, they would go through the pockets of those they had killed and oftentimes pull out photographs of family, you know, mothers or wives or children. And he said he would build a little pyre. He would put them in a little pile and use a lighter and burn them.
And this happens in all wars, right? You saw this over and over again, didn't you? Or heard about it, of course.
Uh-huh. Yeah, it happens. It's a very, I mean, of course, I knew what questions to ask. I'd been there. And, his name is George Packard, and he's a really interesting guy. But he describes it, you know, he says when he first comes home to the war, from the war, it's as if he says he was wrapped in cellophane. He didn't know what he felt. He couldn't cope with his own trauma. That it was only years and years later that he began to deal with how deeply he had been scarred by that experience. And he went into the church and became an Episcopal priest in large part because of not only what he did in the war, but, you know, and he's a deeply honest man, but the fact that he enjoyed it, the fact that he had, you know, the U.S. Army had turned him into a highly competent professional killer, and it's something he liked to do.
Yeah.
And I think that that's one of the darkest and hardest things for people who come out of that experience to acknowledge, at least publicly.
But wouldn't you think it would be harder for someone who couldn't come to terms with it and never acknowledge the reason why they were so uncomfortable with themselves?
Ultimately.
At least he's on the path to trying to redeem it.
Well, it's on the path to mental health, of
mm-hmm,
course.
Mm-hmm.
Although, you know, he suffers, and I don't want to in any way diminish the fact, and he always will for the rest of his life. I mean, there are just memories and scars that he must carry as his burden that, you know, I wouldn't wish on anyone.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I think you're right. I think that what happens is that it those who come out of that experience go in often two radically different ways. One, and I think we see it with the Swift Boat Veterans for Peace. I mean, these thugs who, you know,
tried to undermine
John Kerry. You know, these are people who don't want to publicly and maybe even privately confront the atrocities and the brutality that they carried out. And so they gloss it over in the name of patriotism and honor and glory and all that kind of stuff, which I can tell you, having been in war, I mean, those words not only very quickly become abstractions, but usually obscene in the midst of combat. And those who, like Bishop Packard, turn and confront the capacity we all have for evil within us. And I think that people like Packard who come back, in a way, have a prophetic voice, because one of the things that I think those of us that have not, or those who have not been exposed to that kind of experience, don't understand is that we all have the capacity for evil and committing acts of evil, and that that line between the victim and the victimizer is razor thin. You know, the fear, the contagion of the crowd, the intoxication of violence makes it very easy for all of us to commit atrocious acts, or at least remain silent and do nothing while they are being committed.
Yeah.
And the fact is that those that we would all like to think that we, you know, we're great and courageous people, but having been caught up in that milieu of war, one of the hard things that you have to confront is that you're not the person you thought you were.
Mm-hmm.
That fear has a way of just taking over your body. You cling, especially when forces outside your group threaten you, you cling to that group. And you do things that, you know, in a more rational, thoughtful, certainly compassionate moment, you would never do. Those who actually stand up and confront the intoxication of the crowd, the frenzy of the crowd, especially when it's on a killing spree, are, you know, very rare and isolated individuals. One thinks of the helicopter pilot during the My Lai massacre, you know, the only one to actively intervene to try and stop the killing of Vietnamese civilians.
Yeah.
And of course, not surprisingly, I think he was the only one, or certainly one of the only ones there who had children. That's a huge dividing line in war. I've done it, you know, when I didn't have children, and did it when I did have children.
It makes a big difference, huh?
Well, you never look at the suffering of a child the same way after you have a child of your own. It becomes a lot. You understand as a parent the fragility and a perhaps even sanctity of life in a way that you don't before you have children.
Yeah.
Certainly not at that depth. And, of course, that's why, you know, most militaries rely on 18 and 19-year-old kids to do their killing for them.
Yeah. Let's move on. We're not going to have too much time left. I want to talk to you about the Eighth Commandment, you shall not steal, because this culture is filled with theft, especially among the financial power brokers in this culture. Talk to us about that chapter.
I did insider trading. It was somebody who went to prison for insider trading. I think, you know, we are increasingly living in a culture where theft at that level is, you know, not only tolerated but rewarded. I mean, look at the contracts with Halliburton. We're really radically restructuring American society. I mean, we are rapidly creating an oligarchy. I mean, in many ways, it reminds me of the Middle East or of Latin America, where the middle class is getting wiped out. The working class in this country is. And half of my family comes from the working class, suffering in tremendous ways. I mean, you know, because of the reliance on illegal immigrants, you know, people who used to make decent livings, even in the construction trade, if they can get a job, the salaries are cut in half. Manufacturing jobs have fled. So those people, I mean, look at the compensation that's given to CEOs.
Oh, it's obscene.
Right. I mean, I read something in the paper, it may have been in the New York Times the other day. You know, they were talking about the ratio between a worker's salary and a CEO, and in Britain it's like, I don't know, 1 to 23 or 1 to 50. And here it's like 1 to 427 or something.
Oh, yeah, I saw that too. It's unbelievable.
There is a kind of... rampant greed that has overtaken the society, and I think part of the silence on the part of most of us who are not getting rich off of all this stuff is this false illusion that somehow we can enter the club.
Mm.
You know, we don't want to say anything because once we get there, we can get rich too.
Yeah.
And you see it on, and we're fed this myth or lie by the bucketful on television shows and on the media, and you know, with this obsession with sort of lifestyle and the rich and celebrity and Donald Trump and all this kind of stuff. But you know, there's been, and of course the other big factor is the destruction of regulatory agencies, which began during the Reagan administration.
I'm just going to say, because you identified that you thought this greed and thievery began in the Reagan years.
Well, it did, mm-hmm. clearly, because mm-hmm. And we saw it with the insider trading scandals. The mechanisms that had been put in place to essentially monitor this kind of abuse of investor funds. And remember, the big investors never get burned.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the savings and loan scandal cost, what was it?
You're talking about the Keating scandal?
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah. I mean, people were completely wiped out. I mean, families lost all the money for their retirement. You know, they lost all the money they'd set aside for their
children's college.
I mean, these were not, and of course the federal government bails them out. With staggering sums. I think the figure's in the book, but I think it's $400 billion, or I mean, it's gigantic.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so this oligarchic power lies, cheats, and steals and enriches themselves. And of course, now with this government, this administration in the hands of the oligarchy, they cover up for them.
Mm-hmm.
You see the kind of erosion of public trust and erosion of moral probity just in the way the Bush administration will handle, like for instance the torture issue. I mean, they'll get caught on something and then they'll go back to the Republican-controlled Congress and pass legislation that makes this illegal activity that they've carried out not only legal but retroactively
mm-hmm.
legal.
Mm-hmm.
So there is this kind of feeling that. You know, there is no right and wrong. You know, as long as you can get away with it.
It does feel right. This is a lawless country in some ways at this point.
Increasingly. And mm-hmm. I think those of us that have covered disintegrating societies, as I have, whether, you know, it's the former Yugoslavia or Algeria or countries in Latin America, there are just all sorts of warning lights that are going off, that there is a frightening destruction of that democratic core, that democratic center. And I think we're very complacent about it. I think we don't understand how delicate and fragile it is, and how once it's destroyed, how hard it's going to be to get it back.
Mm-hmm. We are almost out of time. I just want to talk to you just for a couple minutes about the end of your book when you do talk about love. So there is a kind of an up note in the end of your book. Did you believe there's a way back for us in regard to what we've just been talking about?
Well, I mean, having just spent a year with a Christian right, I'm a little pessimistic or a little depressed about where we're headed. But I think that, you know, the great hope is sort of, you know, blind human kindness, those acts of compassion that, you know, especially when we reach out to the stranger or to those branded as the enemy. And you know, totalitarian movements or repressive movements hate those acts of compassion. And that's mm-hmm. really, you know, it's not... It's usually not a huge, you know, war, life is not a battle between good and evil so much as it is a battle between a great evil and kindness, mm-hmm. human kindness. I know it sounds hokey, but having lived in the midst of repressive societies, that kind of kindness takes great moral and often physical courage and stands as a kind of witness to our own humanity. And I find my hope in that.
Chris Hedges, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Out of Bounds is produced by Tim Reppert at Rep Studio in Ithaca. We are a project of the Women's Interfaith Institute in Seneca Falls. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. If you want to talk to us, you can email us at weos@hws.edu. We'll be back next week. I'm Tish Perlman.